Welcome to the Miami Reporters Roundtable Podcast. I'm your host, Peter Vlusky of Condo Vulture. What we are going to discuss this podcast, we have the Florida insurance crisis. We have the preliminary finding by the feds as to a collapse of a condo tower in Surfside, which was a disaster. Nearly 100 people died, $1 billion payout. We're also going to talk about spring break in South Beach. We will have a story about the office market in Miami cooling. We also have $120 million being asked for some luxury condo in Miami Beach. And then finally, a German auto manufacturer decided to lend its name to a condo. We'll discuss all that on the latest episode of the Miami Reporters Roundtable Podcast.
Welcome to the CondoVultures.com podcast with your host, Peter Zalewski, a Miami real estate broker, Wall Street consultant, and expert witness. This podcast is focused on identifying real estate buying opportunities in the South Florida condo market, Miami-Dade, Broward, and Palm Beach counties. The CondoVultures.com podcast is not authorized by the South Florida real estate industry and will most likely annoy many of the region's talking heads. This podcast will feature straight talk and salty language that could be offensive to some. Please remember that past investment success does not determine future gains, especially in South Florida's volatile condo market. For more information, please visit CondoVultures.com. Don't buy a South Florida condo, discounted or distressed, before taking a Condo Vultures correction tour. CondoVultures.com offers weekly bus and walking tours that focus on educating buyers on the how-tos of identifying discounted condos, analyzing the opportunities, and purchasing units. Every tour attendee receives a list of all condo projects in a particular market, a market assessment handout, and unmatched expert analysis. For more information on the condo correction tours, please visit condovultures.eventbrite.com.
This is Peter Zalewski of the Condo Vultures podcast. I hope you're enjoying the podcast. And I wanted to alert you that if you have a property that you're looking to sell in the Tri-County South Florida area, I would encourage you to reach out to Jenny Cortez, a licensed real estate broker with CVRRealty.com. She's my partner. She's been in the business for north of 15 years. More importantly, she knows the market. She knows how to get that deal done. And she also realized that it's more important to get a price that you can accept and sell the property rather than to hold firm on some price that's never going to be achieved and ultimately languish on the market. So if you're looking to do a deal that you want a skilled expert who can help you sell a property, reach out to Jenny Cortez at 305-865-5859, 305-865-5859, or visit her website, CVRRealty.com. Welcome to Miami Reporters Roundtable Podcast. I'm your host, Peter Zalewski from Condo Vultures. If you're tuning in to this podcast, you're going to hear a conversation by, this case, former journalist, discussing some of the biggest stories that have occurred within the last few weeks. We're going to basically cut through all the fluff and give you straight talk as to what's really going on. Miami real estate is really driven by hyperbole. It is a sell-side market. A lot of people in the industry, they eat what they kill, meaning if they can sell you on something, they're going to put a commission in their pocket. They're going to be able to therefore go out, pay their mortgage, pay for their luxury car, and do a variety of different things. What our mission is to try to cut through all that and give you the audience an idea of what might really be going on. The reason we're going to former journalists is that they tend to be straight shooters. They tend to have a little bit of a cynical type of perspective, and maybe they'll give you the other side of the trade. Because a lot of times when you knock on a door, you can hear everything that's rosy and positive. I don't want to say convention or visitor bureau, but it's pretty much synonymous with a lot of the pitches you'll hear down here in South Florida. We're an unauthorized podcast. We've not been saying or approved by anyone in the real estate industry. We've not been approved by anyone with the mayor's office, no one with the Economic Development Council. So our objective, again, straight talk. I handpicked six stories. I have three other journalists on the podcast with me. I sent them off all these articles, asked them each to read two articles. And then what we're going to do is I'm going to read the headline. I'm going to read the first couple graphs. Then I am going to turn around and ask these journalists to go ahead and make a comment. Once the original comment is made by whichever journalist I assigned it to, then the other journalists have an opportunity to sort of chime in. So those are the rules of engagement. Let me introduce you to some of our different members of the podcast. So we have a gentleman who was a journalist for over 25 years, worked at a variety of different publications, including the Tampa Tribune. Right now, he has a publications marketing firm called Gruce Communications. No one else but John Gruce. John has a website, which is GrucePR.com, G-R-U-S-S-P-R.com. And if you want to check him out on X, which is formerly Twitter, you can get John at John, J-E-A-N, Gruce, G-R-U-S-S. What's going on, Mr. Gruce? Long time no see.
Hey, Peter. Glad to be back on the unauthorized podcast.
It is an unauthorized podcast. Mr. Gruce, last time we did a podcast was back in December, and then we all kind of went on a hiatus. You were more fortunate than many. You were visiting the Caribbean, doing some diving, doing some business and a variety of other things. Why don't you give us a synopsis as to what you did and what you saw and what the climate's like in the Caribbean?
Yeah, it's great, but I almost stayed there and didn't come back. So it's good to be back in crazy Miami.
It's good to be back in crazy Miami. That is a perfect segue for another one of our regular journalists on our podcast. This is a gentleman who was a journalist for over 20 years, wrote for a variety of different publications, including the South Florida Business Journal. Right now, he does public relations and marketing consulting. No one else but John Fett. But if you want to get a hold of John, you can get him on X, which is formerly Twitter. Get him at JT Fackler, JTFAKLER. Mr. Fackler, how are you?
Doing great, Peter. It's great to be back on the podcast.
It's great to have you, Mr. Fackler. We had a little hiatus. What were you up to during that time?
Really, not too much. Pretty much hunkering down. Haven't really done much traveling. So really nothing exciting to report, such as Jean, but doing great.
Fantastic, fantastic. And as is our tradition in season 5, we always have a gentleman who was a journalist for over 20 years on our first episode. It's somebody who was part of creating the actual podcast. This gentleman was a journalist for over 20 years, worked at the South Florida Business Journal, worked over at the Associated Press, did time at the Miami Herald. Right now, he does public relations, and he also does real estate, which we're going to have to hear about. No one else but Oscar Musibi. If you want to check out Oscar on Twitter, get him at O-M-U-S-I-B-A-Y. Oscar Musibi, at O-M-U-S-I-B-A-Y. Mr. Musibi, how are you?
I'm great. I'm wearing my flower shirt, which always makes me happy, and I'm excited to be at the start of a new season, and I'm looking forward to hearing all your great thoughts on real estate.
Mr. Musibi, you've made the transition into real estate. You are now on the sell side of the market. Before, you were a journalist a long time. You also still, I think, are still doing some population. Why don't you give the audience kind of an overview as to, what you're up to and what kind of services you might offer if they're interested or if they want to just reach out to you.
So I made the transition because I've learned so much about real estate, but always when you're a reporter, you're an observer. You don't really have any skin in the game. So first I left journalism, became a public relations person, and then I decided I still didn't have enough skin or hair in the game. So I got into real estate, and now I'm focused on commercial, which is land, office buildings, whatever might be in the market at the time. I mean, right now there's a lot of activity in commercial. Commercial's very strong, particularly in the industrial sector. I'm not involved in industrial, but pretty much everything else I'm interested in. So if you have an office building to sell or you have land available that you want a developer to look at, look me up on Twitter.
Look you up on Twitter. So let me lay out what we're going to be doing before I go ahead and we begin with the stories. So this is season 5. We're scheduled to do about 20 episodes. We're going to be doing them every week. Our goal is to try to get into live streaming. So typically what we'll do is we'll live stream on a Tuesday, and then I'll go ahead and I'll edit it all down. And we'll come up with a polished product, which will come out every Friday for your consumption, if you will. If you have any questions for us, if you want to reach out to us, please feel free to send us a message on X, which is formerly Twitter. Get us at Miami RRP, at Miami RRP. It stands for Miami Reporters Roundtable Podcast. It is not AARP, even though some of my colleagues on the podcast, they might qualify for AARP, but we are Miami RRP. So I always like to kind of get that in there. And then in terms of sponsorship, the only sponsor for this podcast is actually my firm, and it is condovultures.com, condovultures.com. We basically collect information, we analyze data, we go ahead and we put it out there, and we have a variety of different services. So I'd encourage everybody to sort of check it out. And as part of that pitch that I'm going to make, we have a newsletter that goes out. It goes out weekly. It's in-depth. We roll up the sleeves. We dig in some data, and we're giving you some ideas of what's really going on in various markets. We've already done Greater Downtown Miami. We've done Miami Beach. Right now, we're focused on Sunny Isles Beach. And then going forward, we'll be looking at Hollywood, Hallandale, Fort Lauderdale, going all the way up to West Palm Beach. So that is the pitch, condovultures.com. So all that being said, let's go ahead and get into our stories. Again, 6 stories. I read the headline. I read the first couple graphs, and I go to the journalists, and I ask them to give me their take on it. So, Mr. Chris, we're going to start off with you. You're nice and rested. You were traveling throughout the Caribbean. You're diving, probably kicking back, maybe throwing a few back. So you're probably the most rusted of all of us. So let's start off with you. We're going to go, we're going to discuss a story that comes out of the South Florida Sun Sentinel. The headline is many Florida insurance bills approved by legislature aimed to save homeowners money. And if you're not aware of it, what happened is back during the pandemic, there was the collapse of a condominium tower. And also too shortly thereafter, there were some hurricanes that rolled through. And as a result, insurance companies are really taking it hard in terms of trying to go ahead and provide insurance for residential real estate or even commercial real estate in the state. So the legislature, realizing there's no state income tax, realizing that real estate is what fills the coffers, what they're trying to do is they're trying to bring insurance prices under somewhat of control. So some steps have been taken this recent Florida legislative session. And the story is about what we can anticipate based on the session that just recently ended. So Mr. Gruce, again, the South Florida Sun Sentinel headline, many Florida insurance business bills approved by legislature aimed to save homeowners money. I'll read you the first couple graphs, Mr. Gruce, then I want you to provide some insight. Here we go. Florida home insurance consumers got a mixed bag from Florida legislature this year. Lawmakers approved $200 million, a $200 million extension of the My Safe Florida Home program and created separate programs to help condo owners. But a bill allowing surplus lines line carriers to take out second home policies from state-owned Citizens Property Insurance Corporation was approved, which critics say could subject snowbirds to failures by insurers whose policies are not guaranteed by the Florida Insurance Guarantee Association. Legislature also failed to approve bills that would allow the Office of Insurance Regulation to increase limits on insurable values eligible for citizens coverage and prevent cancellation of or non-renewal of policies covering flood damage at homes. Mr. Gruce, that's a lot there. You went through, you read the article. Why don't you give us the takeaway? If somebody owns real estate, whether they're a primary user or whether or not they're a second home buyer or a snowbird, what really kind of came out of the legislative session that recently ended up in Tallahassee, Florida?
Nothing. Nothing. It's just tinkering on the edges. It's just diddling with what is really a massive, massive problem. And it's a never-ending story. This story has been going on for 30-plus years, ever since Hurricane Andrew and the creation of Citizens, the state's insurer of last resort. This story is a never-ending story of Florida. And basically, it comes down to whether Floridians want subsidized homeownership insurance or not. And this is the never-ending debate about Citizens, the role of the state, and the role of subsidies in the insurance market, and whether it should be a free market or whether it should be a state market. This is a never-ending story, and we never seem to resolve it. And it goes on, year after year after year. This is a never-ending story, and we are suffering the consequences of it with, you know, spiking rates. Nobody's happy. And the legislature just diddles and tinkers with the programs. And meanwhile, the rates keep going up. I will say, though, that, you know, obviously you mentioned real estate. I mean, real estate is the business of Florida. And so tourism, insurance, all of these things are aimed at, you know, making sure that the real estate market functions smoothly. And right now, there's a lot of people that are very unhappy about the insurance markets and what that's doing to the real estate industry and, you know, real estate sales and, you know, the mess of the condos. I mean, it's just a huge mess. So eventually, I mean, I think the direction that we might be headed in is a full subsidized program that insures homeowners. But I mean, you're seeing right now the debates going on, like of whether and how much that should happen. So More of the same, and nothing will get the resolve this year. And everything that happened in this legislature is just tinkering around the edges.
No, Mr. Gruce, rapid fire, just a couple quick questions. Yes or no is all that is suffice. And you're obviously not an expert in insurance. You used to write about the financial matters. You used to write about business. You wrote about stocks. You wrote about,
I wrote about insurance.
Write about insurance. Okay.
I wrote about insurance. A lot, over the years, because it's a critical component of economic development and real estate sales. And it's just one of those stories that, you know, got passed around the newsroom
You know, everybody wrote insurance stories. Everybody's written about the insurance crisis.
No, Mr. Gruce. Back in season four, we talked about how Citizens, which is the public-private insurance company, state of Florida, it's an insurer of last resort. But ironically, Citizens charges lower prices than private sector. Yes or no? Was that resolved? Is Citizens still cheaper than the private sector, or was anything done in order to make it the insurer of last resort price-wise?
Well, it's the insurer of last resort. So if you can't get insurance anywhere, you'll get it from Citizens. I mean,
In some cases it is.
Yes.
Okay.
I mean, let's just say that it's not priced adequately for the risk.
Okay. That's fair.
That it's
that's
taken.
Fair.
Yeah.
Okay. Okay. Another question. I'm doing my condo tours. I'm talking to a lot of people looking at condos. One of the issues that they're running into is that when you look at a maintenance fee for a tower, let's say downtown Miami, if they were to go and buy a condo in greater downtown Miami, they're looking at about 80 cents a square foot per month in terms of their maintenance fee, of which about 20% is earmarked for insurance costs based on the people I spoke to who run property management companies. So what I'm wondering, Mr. Gruce, a lot of investors are getting jammed up. They're fearful of buying into a condominium because there doesn't seem to be a cap in terms of how much insurance could go up as they go forward. Because rents have a cap, everything else has a cap. So did the legislature do anything to try to get the insurance costs that is impacting so many prospective buyers of condos? Is there any reason that they should be hopeful, or is it still just blowing with the wind and going up with the rest of inflation?
No, it's worse than inflation. I'm hearing 40 to 50% increases in rates in condo towers. There's no cap. There's no cap to taxes, by the way.
Yeah, right.
Raise your taxes too. And you know, obviously if your property values go up, your taxes will go up too. Even if the millage rate stays the same, right?
Got it.
So I mean what investors are facing now is the uncertainty of what their maintenance fees are going to be. I mean, they could go up by, you know, I mean, they could, there's no limit to how much they can go up. It's just a big crisis. And if I were an investor or condo buyer, I would be extremely, extremely leery. And I would probably wait until, you know, this year is passed to see at least the beginning of the year to see what the insurance costs are going to be.
Yep.
People are going to be shocked, I think.
And then finally, Mr. Gruce, anything in the legislature that dealt with what a lot of people are concerned with, and that is reserves that condo associations are going to have to sort of set aside as we go into 2025 as a result of the collapse, that Surfside disaster where nearly 100 people died, $1 billion was paid out as a result of the building collapsing. But now a bunch of rules are in place and requirements are in place where associations are going to have to basically put money in reserves to get work done rather than kicking the can. Was there anything in the legislation that kind of dealt with this looming deadline of 2025? Even though
Not that I know of.
Not that you know of. Okay. Okay. And I'm sure we'll see it as time goes by. Okay. Fantastic.
So, Peter, can I say something on this topic?
Yes, please, Oscar.
So I've done a lot of research on insurance in the last couple of years. And yes, insurance is high. There's no question. But I think also part of what homeowners can do and new homeowners can do is to try different strategies to try and reduce the cost. Because oftentimes what happens is that you get a policy that's written for you and you don't think that you can make changes, but you actually can. And there are ways to lower your costs. So for example, you can talk to your insurance agent. Let them know you're interested in lowering your premium. And you can look at different parts of the house that if you improve those parts, you reduce your insurance costs. So a roof can be that, windows can be that. In some cases, policies cover things that are never going to be replaced, like an exterior fence or something like that. The insurance companies have become much more careful as to how they do payouts. So you should ask them about, you know, what is absolutely necessary to cover. Maybe you have a higher payment per month, but that brings down your premium. So there are lots of different things that you can work with your insurance agent and see if you can reduce your premium overall. And I know in my case, we had a high premium. We shopped around because we got a new management company and they got a great rate for us. Amazing rate. So sometimes you have an agent you've been working with for 40 years. That person is locked into something with a company for whatever reason, and they're not really being aggressive about looking around. But if you work with a management company that covers many condominium associations, sometimes they can find policies that are less expensive. So I think there are ways to mitigate it. You know, it's still an issue like everything else in Florida.
That's a great point, Oscar. Thank you for adding that. And I will mention my conversations with people in the insurance industry. They make a 10% commission based on the policy they put out, just to let that be known to the audience. So Oscar, we're going to stick with you with story number two. Story number two, I sort of referenced when Jean was giving his overview about what happened based on the recent legislative session. And that is the disaster that occurred in Surfside, which is a community on the barrier island located between Miami Beach and Sunny Isles and Bell Harbor. As mentioned, about 100 people died, $98 billion settlement was paid out. So the federal government has sent down a group to go ahead and take a look at it. They're spending a ton of cash to try to understand how could the tower collapse, because they want to try to avoid it in the future. So a tentative determination has come out. So that's what the story is about. It's coming out of National Public Radio, NPR. So Oscar, I'll read you the headline, first couple of graphs, and I want you to comment. Headline, again, NPR. Investigators narrow search into cause of deadly Florida condo collapse in Surfside. And here we go, first couple of graphs. A federal team investigating the cause of the 2021 collapse of a Florida condominium tower continues to focus on construction flaws in the building's pool deck. 98 people died when the Champlain Tower South condominium came down in Surfside. A team from the National Institute of Standards and Technology has spent nearly $30 million gathering evidence and testing materials used in the building's construction. In an update Thursday at a NIST headquarters in Gatlinburg, Maryland, investigators said tests show concrete used in the pool deck and in the columns that supported it were weaker than required by building codes. In addition, because of added weight from planters that had been added to the pool area years later, the deck and columns were subjected to more stress than they were designed for. Because of design flaws, investigators say water from the depth constantly seeped into the garage area under the pool, helping to corrode steel in the support columns. But Glenn Bell, NIST's co-lead investigator, says videos also show there was a movement in the tower structure itself before the collapse. Mr. Musabai, a lot of money and a lot of experts are taking a look at this for obvious reasons. This is something that's going to take a long time to finally come to a determination. What's your sense so far from what you're reading, what you're hearing, and how worried should people be if they live in a condominium that was built several years ago? This particular building was built in the 80s. How worried should individual unit owners be about living in their places, especially if they have a pool deck that's fronting the Atlantic Ocean and is on the sands?
So I think the reality of living in Miami Beach and Miami overall is that water is pretty much everywhere where high rises are going to be. And the reality is that over the years, boards have to be aggressive and bring in inspectors regularly to make sure that they get accurate and up-to-date information about how buildings are faring in the weather that we have, and to make sure that they're not ignoring those reports. Because there are, you know, boards are made up of regular homeowners, and sometimes they're incentivized not to pay attention to things like this because the costs might be too high to repair, or maybe they're going to sell and they don't want to, you know, lower the value of their property. I think that overall people are great and they're going to do the best job they can. And in these buildings, I think that whether it's two stories or, you know, 110 feet, you got to make sure that every component of the project is checked regularly and that it's people who are reliable. I remember reading stories about some of the people that were inspecting that building, and there were questions about the reliability of some of the reports that they made. And I know that the story that I read said that the report seemed to indicate that the pool was probably where the collapse began. So as they had thought originally from the video that they had seen. So you know, it's very similar to what happened after Andrew, because what happened after Andrew is that we saw all this incredible damage that was done in South Miami-Dade County. And they realized...
Oscar, if I could interrupt you, anybody who doesn't know what Andrew is, could you just give them like a... Just catch them up to date when you're referring to it, Hurricane Andrew in August of 1992.
So Andrew was a Category 5 hurricane. Is that correct? That's my recollection. It was a cat.
Yes.
And what happened was that it came through South Dade and it spawned tornadoes. So not only did you have this very slow moving hurricane that went over the land, but it also spawned tornadoes that devastated neighborhoods. So when you saw the video of these neighborhoods, you would see one block that was perfectly normal, and then the next block that was completely gone. All the roofs were gone. You would see a boat next to a house that had been in a river or, you know, somewhere else near the water. And people were astounded as to how much damage it created. And what they realized is that a lot of the houses that had been built prior to the hurricane had not had the proper infrastructure. And that created a lot of problem and a lot of damage. And as a result, they changed the construction rules as to how houses had to be built. And the same thing is happening in Miami-Dade, and particularly on the coast, with older buildings and new buildings. Everything has to be checked. Everything has to be, you know, reinforced. In some cases, architects are actually building structures that have levels on the ground floor that are designed to flood. So if there is a problem and there's a lot of flooding and that happens in Miami Beach, it will be salvageable or the damage will be limited. So these are some of the things that we're doing in Florida, and specifically in South Florida, to address these issues. And I think the Surfside situation will continue to yield information that will be helpful to us as we continue forward.
Fantastic, Oscar. Thank you for that. John Fackler, we're going to go to you with story number 3. It's coming out of the Miami Herald. Over the course of our history, and this is season 5, we've done a lot with the spring break in what sort of transpired down here in Miami. During the pandemic, the state of Florida was pretty much open. Masks were not an issue. If you wanted to come on down, spend some money. A lot of people came here for spring break. It turned into all kinds of situations. Plenty of us remember videos of people twerking on police cars. Recently, there were some shootings during spring break. It's just been a whole bunch of chaos. Current administration, or a lot of the officials have been elected in Miami Beach, they actually ran on a platform of trying to clamp down on spring break and some of the stuff that sort of was related to that. So we're right now recording this in March of 2024. There's spring break going on as we speak. So I'm going to refer to a story, or I'm going to read you the headline and the first couple of graphs of a story coming out of the Miami Herald. So here we go. In quotes, bringing the country to the city, cowboys rode horses on Ocean Drive during spring break. So last year we had twerking. This year we got cowboys, Mr. Fackler. So I want to get your comment on this. First couple of graphs. Stephen Harmon ignored Miami Beach's persistent messaging to stay away, choosing instead to trot along Ocean Drive on his trusty white seat Tango because he was on a far more important mission, bringing the country to the city. And this is a quote from Mr. Harmon. He says, every time I take my horse out in the city, I always see somebody that never seen a horse and never been around a horse, according to Mr. Harmon, who was perched up along Tango. And they were a nice little photograph. And by the way, you want to see a picture of Tango? Simply go in the show notes and we have a link in there to it. Story goes on to say Harmon, who's 41, he drove from Hopkins, South Carolina with his 14-year-old Tango and his 9-year-old Little Bit, a pair of standard breed walking horses, to experience his first spring break in Miami Beach. Resident spring breakers and police officers were open mouthed and gawking as Tango and Little Bit strode down Ocean Drive. Harmon said he saw all the messaging from the city and remembered the violence from last year's spring break, but he said it was far more important to bring joy to the people. And here's a quote from Mr. Harmon. Mr. Becker, then I want you to comment. I wasn't scared, but I'm like, it's not going to deter me. I'm not going to change my mind, he said. I said, you know what? I'm going to do that and give people a good experience. We're going to see how it goes. By the way, Mr. Fackler, before you respond, I was at Cayocho, which is the festival, the one-day festival that goes on every year in Little Havana in Miami. And I actually saw Tango and I saw a Little Bit riding around. And I was wondering, what the hell two guys were doing with horses in the middle of the Coyote Festival. So that being said, Mr. Peckler, we had twerking, now we have horses. What's your take on it? And has everything that the current or the newly elected city commission, everything they've done, has it sort of solved the problem, or are we still in the process of figuring that out? Because we're only halfway through March, which is spring break month down here in South Florida.
Well, listen, the only way this gentleman's going to bring any more joy to spring break on Miami Beach is if he trains the horses to twerk, because that is still going on. It's still going to go on. Just to give it some context, though, some of the measures that have been part of this really anti-spring break PR campaign by the city apparently seems to be working. They're doing a lot of crazy things. I mean, they're charging $100 to park. They're shutting down the actual beach at certain times. It's really, you know, obviously designed as a deterrence to keep people away. And apparently up until now, it's actually working to a certain degree. We're going, I think it's the second week, and then the third week is towards the end of March. That's generally when the real trouble begins. Right now, the next weekend and the following weekend, you know, that's when all the shootings and the, you know, crazy-ass behavior goes on. So some of the indications are that it's working to a certain degree, at least up until now. So it's going to be interesting to watch this to see how this develops, because this has been a problem for several years. And, you know, a lot of the businesses have been hurt by this. There's been obviously a crime increase, and there's a lot of politics around this. But, you know, the bottom line is, can they manage spring break by these different activities that they're using to deter? So that, I think we should, you know, maybe check back next week to see how that's gone, to, you know, to get a legitimate idea of what the, you know, bottom line is.
And, all right, story number four. John Bruce, we're going to go to you with story number four. This comes out of the Wall Street Journal. I will read you the headline, first couple of graphs, and I want you to comment. Headline, Miami's office market was red hot. Now, its tallest planned tower can't fill its space. Subhead, the 1,000-foot project under construction is still searching for an anchor tenant. First couple of graphs from Mr. Bruce, and I want you to comment. The challenges swirling around the skyscraper known as One Brickell City Center, which at around 1,000 feet high, would be Miami's tallest corporate tower, show how the city's once sizzling office tower is starting to cool. New York developer Related Companies and Swire Properties, an international development firm founded by the British Swire family, are struggling to find an anchor tenant roughly a year after the groundbreaking. Related is restructuring its agreement with Swire, which owns the land, according to people familiar with the matter. Swire even has considered selling the 1.55-acre site in Miami's downtown. According to a document viewed by the Wall Street Journal, Swire said it continuously evaluates different options for its development sites, and that the one for One Brickell City Center is currently not for sale. Related said it was continuing to work with Swire. Rising interest rates and hybrid work have punished U.S. office market. Miami for years weathered such headwinds better than most cities, thanks in part to the steady stream of corporate relocations and the limited supply of office buildings. Mr. Chris, we're hearing a lot about companies calling people back into the office. 3 days a week is pretty much the norm. For increasingly, it's 4 days a week, Monday through Thursday. You don't have to work. You could work from home on a Friday. There was a story in the Wall Street Journal a few weeks ago talking about how AI has basically surpassed anything else going on. And now everybody's being called to San Francisco and Silicon Valley to work on AI, which is breaking free. And people are bailing on Miami and they're bailing on other places. Mr. Chris, can you sort of pile this together? Are they related? And I'm not talking about related companies, the developer, but I'm saying, is it related that as people are leaving, going back to Silicon Valley after the pandemic relocation era, work from home era, or is this just coincidental?
You know, the interesting thing to me is that the office market nationally has been struggling. There's no doubt about it. And even if people are going back to work for a few days a week, There's no like new absorption of office space. And for some reason, developers here think that Miami is sort of the exception to the national rule. And somehow Miami is unique and unaffected by what's happening in the rest of the country. And that's just not the case. And so what we're seeing now is as the market is cooling, you know, then office buildings are having trouble luring new tenants. And I mean, this is not singling out this particular developer. I think it's citywide. The thing is that Miami is not immune from national trends. And, I think sometimes in Miami, we have the sense that we're different and somehow there's no, what's happening in the rest of the country is really, nothing like what's happening here, and that we should be fine. But, there's developers putting up new office buildings at a time when, office buildings are selling now for below replacement costs in any places in the country. And San Francisco, obviously, being, exhibit A, despite the fact that some people are going back to San Francisco. And I really don't know that it's a wholesale return to San Francisco, but fact of the matter is that office space in San Francisco, Chicago, New York, I mean, there's even as they're calling people back in the office, it's still not back to where it was pre-pandemic. And I don't think we're going back there. And meanwhile, in Miami, we're putting up new office buildings. Yeah, but this time is different. And the new office building, people want to be in Class A space with all these amenities, blah, blah, blah. I mean, I really, we've heard this story before and many times in Florida. And we've seen the results, those of us who've been around a while know what happens.
Mr. Gruce, let me just ask you a follow-up question before I open it up to the floor. Gentleman that came out of Chicago, moved down here, a guy called Ken Griffin, dropped some cash, burned some serious cash on a variety of different things, including a piece of dirt located right on Biscayne Bay, in which he's supposedly going to build his office tower. We're about 2 years after he purchased the property. They just had an announcement. He's actually going to figure out what he's finally going to do with it. The Wall Street Journal goes on to say that Mr. Griffin spoke to Mr. Ross from the related companies who's actually supposed to build this office. And Mr. Griffin didn't want to move into this space. He's going to do it on his own. But yet nothing's gotten done. What do you make of Ken Griffin and his claim of building an office tower, as well as Miami surpassing New York as the capital of finance in the United States, which is a comment he made during season four of our podcast?
Yeah, I mean, look, these kinds of buildings don't just get put up overnight. And then plus, one of the things that Citadel is facing, obviously, is they probably don't have the staff, the traders that they might have in New York or Chicago, to fill up the building. So, it's tough. The office market is tough. And I think, maybe Ken Griffin may be having some second thoughts and he's taking his time, which actually is the smart thing to do. If certainly given the construction costs, insurance, and all the things that we talk about regularly on the podcast, it makes sense that he's taking a go slow approach. And, there's plenty of office space available at reasonable rates. Why put up your own, and certainly, might have something to do with his own business and his outlook for how things are going. So, there's just a lot of moving parts to it. There's a lot of egos, as Stephen Ross and Ken Griffin, they're like billionaire, super ego guys. So I'm sure, they drive a tough bargain with each other. I think there was talk too that Ken Griffin was going to take a minority stake in the Miami Dolphins, as part of the deal. And I don't know, when you have two billionaires going at it, sometimes things don't work out.
Sometimes things don't work out. Let me open up, Oscar. You're right now working at real estate. You're doing office space, things like that. Do you feel comfortable providing any kind of comment, or do you want to sort of just pass on it?
So what I'll say generally is that in Miami, there are submarkets like Coral Gables, Coconut Grove that are doing extremely well. And Miami is a market that has started construction on a lot of new Class A. And generally what that does is it forces the B's and C's to reevaluate their position, because whatever Class A is going to charge is going to impact B's and C's. And everyone who's in a BNC, if they can, they're going to try and figure out a way of getting into an A. Now, I think what is interesting, and John alluded to it, is that maybe the people who can, Bezos, you know, Ross, all these people.
Amazon, right. Jeff Bezos from Amazon, who recently relocated from Seattle to Miami Beach.
Right.
Area.
So what that does, that kind of relocation, what it does is it prompts the staff that works with people at that level, the CEOs, to move here as well. And I think that is part of what is fueling this exuberance, that when you see, you know, a continued parade of billionaires moving here, and they're not the only ones, that is going to continue to drive condominium development. It's luxury condominiums, luxury single family homes, the branding of condominiums, which you're going to talk about soon. All of that is part of this kind of shift of Miami becoming the financial capital. And I think that is a driver that's going to continue. Now, there's no question that the office market has to settle, and that there has to be a perspective on post-COVID Miami and how office reacts to that, right? Because what happened during COVID is that everyone moved here thinking that they were going to be able to work from home, and it drove housing pricing up, and it drove construction up, and it also drove some of this exuberance about office buildings, new office buildings. But now that the companies like Apple and some of these other companies are saying, you got to come back, then that's had an impact on how office space is used. So there's a lot more shared space, and architects and developers are combining uses as well in this new modern office work dynamic, where you'll have rentals in the building. You'll have these very new types of designs for office spaces, and you'll have destination restaurants that are popular not only for the people who live there. And in some cases, you're getting exclusive restaurants inside of these buildings as well that are specific to the residents who live there. So that's like a whole new level of financial status and investment and access that is new to Miami, and that's going to continue. So there's a hiccup in our market like there is in the rest of the country, but we're faring much better than the rest of the country for the most part for newer product, right? Some of the older buildings in other parts of South Florida are having issues in suburban markets, but our markets in Miami, our suburban markets, are extremely strong. So it depends on where you're at.
Interesting. Great point, Oscar. Appreciate that. Oscar, we're going to stick with you with story number 5. This is a piece that's actually coming out of the New York Post. I'll read the headline. I'll read you the first couple graphs, and I want you to comment. Headline: a Miami Beach penthouse is poised to sell for more than $120 million and will break an area sales record. By the way, anybody who wants to get some details on that, I'm a price per square foot guy. I run the numbers real quick. Talk about $11,429 a foot. In our newsletter, we took a deep dive into Miami Beach. There's been 15 sales of north of $4,000 a foot or so in its history. These guys are going to try to push $11,400 a foot. So just imagine that next time you go into your restaurant. So I'll read you the next couple graphs. I'll read you the first couple graphs. An oceanfront penthouse in Miami Beach is in contract for a staggering sum of exceeding $120 million. They didn't say if it's U.S. dollars, though, Oscar. It could be Canadian. But that being said, if sealed at this price, the deal would shatter previous records and secure its position as the most expensive condominium ever sold in the Miami area, according to the Wall Street Journal. New York posted a rewrite of the Wall Street Journal piece. Story goes on to say the buyer's identity remains unknown. Developers, the Witkoff Group and Monroe Capital, did not respond to the journal's request for comment. Serial real estate record breaker Ken Griffin. This is a gentleman from Citadel who moved down to Miami during the pandemic. From Chicago, this gentleman's featured in a movie called Dumb Money. I'd encourage everybody to sort of check it out.
Right now, he owns a piece of dirt in Miami where he wants to build an office tower. He's bought some historical houses, made a real commitment to this area. So that's Ken Griffin. So the story goes on to say, serial real estate record breaker Ken Griffin, the billionaire hedge fund titan, set the most recent record in Miami in 2015 when he paid $60 million for two penthouses at the Argentine developer Alan Faina's Faina House. Griffin has since sold those units for about $46 million. Oscar, what do you make of it? $120 million for a condo that's 10,500 square feet. Granted, it's got a big terrace area in addition to that. But does anything in Miami justify $11,428, $29 a square foot?
So I think that this type of product is really a signal of how Miami has changed, that it's really about what the market will bear. And people like Ken Griffin and others are paying, you know, multi-millions of dollars for properties that they may end up knocking down because they want to build the ultimate mansion that they can flip in a few years if they want for more money. It's an investment. You know, most of us think of buying a house as the place we're going to live, right? Where our kids are going to be, where we have guests. And the reality is that for many people at that level, at the ultimate level of wealth, it's about an investment. It's about, okay, if I'm gonna do this, I'm gonna take it to the nth degree. I'm gonna make this as luxurious as possible. I'm gonna set a standard that's gonna be the highest they can be until someone surpasses it. I mean, New York is that kind of city where you have building after building after building that is setting a higher standard for luxury. And you were just saying at the beginning of the podcast that Miami has now surpassed New York in terms of financial, being the financial capital. And
No. I didn't say that. Ken Griffin.
All right.
From Citadel. So he made the declaration in season four of the podcast.
Yes.
That New York is the have-beens and Miami is where it's going.
So what's interesting is that back in 2000, I remember reporting on lists that would come out every year and say,
yep,
what cities were the wealthiest people looking at as the best place to put their money, right? And Miami had not yet broken that list, but the prediction was that it would. And now we're at the point where someone like Ken Griffin is saying that we have made it to that point. And he's not just saying that. He's not someone who would just say something like a throwaway line because his credibility is at stake. So him saying it adds a lot of authority and a lot of credibility to Miami as a whole. And there are a lot of family offices that are more aggressive and more active in markets, specifically in Miami. So I think that what's also interesting is that along with that, condominiums in particular are looking for branding that will help them differentiate themselves from other product. And your next story is going to be about that.
Yes.
And I think that what that tells you.
But Oscar, though, just so we're clear, you talk about branding. The branding of this project is called the Short Club.
Yes. But the Short Club in Miami is known as is a known quantity. It's one of the most, elite type of products in the marketplace.
Well, I can tell you what I know of the Short Club. Last time I went in there when it was still operational, they had some problem with their air conditioner. And it was like a musty smell when you walked in. But it was never cold enough. Yeah. The units were small. Granted, it's a great piece of dirt. Anybody doesn't know where the dirt is? It's about 20th or so in Collins, just south of the Satay.
Right.
And near kind of near Carl Collins Park where some of the museums are and stuff like that.
So the idea is that in markets where the economy is not as strong as it could be or where there's distress, that's where people like Ken Griffin and others are looking for opportunity, because the Short Club, whichever location it might be, I mean, that's how Gil Deser and his family made all their money. The same with other very high profile entrepreneurs in Miami who
Gil Deser from Sunny Isles fame, who's built a variety of different towers. Right now, he's working on a project called the Bentley, where he has his famous Deservator in there, where you drive your car into his Deservator, which is trademarked and patented, and it takes you up to your unit, and you park your car outside your unit.
So I think, like, the rest of our culture, American culture, is that people who have a lot of money look for brands that they can trust, that are high quality, that will give them prestige. And our condominium marketplace is exactly the same. And they're looking for properties that are familiar, names that are familiar, that are household names. And they're gonna make them into something we've never seen before that raises the level of luxury and also of expectation and of exclusivity, right? And I think that's what all these properties represent. And I'll leave it at that because I know you have another story.
Yeah, I appreciate that. That's my story. Okay.
Sorry about that. Yeah.
Mr. Factor, $120 million on a condo in Miami Beach in the 20th and Collins. Is this crazy? Is this the pinnacle of the run-up as a result of the pandemic and the free cash and the stock market run, Bitcoin hitting 72,000, or is this actually justified? Is this being built on sand? Figuratively, literally it is, but figuratively, is it being built on sand, or is there cement and some kind of foundation below $120 million for a condo?
I think a ceiling has been met as far as the price of condos, the luxury condos. What's happening is that developers are trying to separate themselves from their competition. So what they're doing is they are aligning themselves with luxury branded condos.
Yeah, but Mr. Factor, this project's called the Short Club. Short of somebody who's been around Miami Beach for quite some time, they don't know what the hell the Short Club is. It is a generic name that I don't think anybody would recognize unless you like an old timer who probably can refer to the Rascal House and Wolfie's. But short of that, who the hell knows the Short Club in Miami Beach? You got to be a little long in the tooth to recognize that.
Well, I think it's a complete fantasy. Oh. I mean, it's just how high can you go? You know, and it's just typical of the boom and bust cycles of Florida. You know, this is the same story over and over and over. Everybody's drinking the Kool-Aid. Oh, these are luxurious properties. Everybody's going to come down and pay more than the next guy. And everybody thinks that they got in on a great deal. And the next guy pays more and the next guy pays more until the music stops. And the music's going to stop. And when it does, you're going to have a lot of empty buildings and a lot of cranes up there. I'm looking at cranes outside my window, and they're not going to be building anymore. And in fact, we've seen some stories already that some developers are actually shelving plans for new condos because there is a tsunami of condos coming. The supply is going to overwhelm the market. There's only a finite number of people who can pay these multi-million dollar condos. And we're going to have an epic bust, just like we do every 10, 15, 20 years in Florida. It's the story of Florida. This is like...
But Peter, what are your numbers?
I don't know. It just seems like it's just like a repeat of every cycle that we've gone through since the 1920s. So, I mean, this is the same story.
Peter, what are your numbers? What do your numbers say about the inventory right now, the condo luxury inventory?
Going through the stats, what I can tell you is supply is going up because listings are going up, but nobody's buying. The days on the market that condo resales are sitting there is doubling what it took last year, 2023, in order to transact a unit. Mm-hmm. And I would tell you days on market will reflect buyer sentiment. If they really want something, it's kind of like back in the day when there were an open house and there'd be like 30 people coming through and there were 15 offers. Well, those days are gone. Right now, properties are just sitting there months upon months. Without being able to sell, which means the seller, at some point, they realize what they have is really a commodity and they're going to have to price it as such, just like he would price unleaded gasoline. I would buy the 87, even though I haven't had a car in 11 years, rather than the 93. So this, the $120 million condo, who the hell knows what it's worth? We're going to go with story number six. Mr. Factor, we're going to go to you. John Factor, we'll go to you with story number six. It's coming out of the South Florida Business Journal. I'll read you the headline for a couple graphs. Then I want you to comment. Headline. Mercedes-Benz plans its first North American condo in Miami's Brickell area. Prices start at about $550,000 a door. First couple graphs are JDS Development Group will partner with Mercedes-Benz AG to brand the condos in its 67-story mixed-use tower in Miami's Brickell neighborhood. By the way, anybody's interested, want to know where this is? It's basically off of 12th. It's a block west of the Metrorail tracks. So
So it's actually in West Brickell. Anybody knows East Brickell and West Brickell? A little bit of difference in pricing. But that being said, I'll go on with the story. This would be Mercedes' first North American condo project. According to the company, 791 units in the residential tower will be branded Mercedes-Benz Place. And the German automaker's design team, in collaboration with New York-based Shop Architects, refined the design of the building based on its sensual purity concept. And it goes on to say, and there's a quote here from Chief Design Officer for Mercedes-Benz. He says, this philosophy, based on the duality of emotion and intelligence, consists of a hot and cool pole. The cool aspect represents very much the tradition of geometric German long-lived design originated in the Bauhaus. This crucial part of our brand was the inspiration for the architecture of this extraordinary new Mercedes-Benz Place landmark in Miami. Mr. Pfeffer, why don't you give us your take? And I was wondering if you could like give us some kind of context about the hot and the cool pole that this designer from Mercedes-Benz is referring to.
I have no idea what that means, the hot and the cool pole. But I can tell you that, getting back to my earlier point.
You want to market it to your audience. So I figured you might be able to help us understand the audience what this German designer is referring to.
Not really sure exactly what that means, but I will say that, you know, when you get into the highfalutin world of high-end real estate, such as in this case, I mean, there's, you know, I mean, obviously the developers are trying to separate themselves from each other. It's very competitive. So right now, you know, the market for, according to the New York Times, as a recent story, the market for these luxury branded condos is growing by 12% a year. And that's through 2026. So apparently they've hit the mother load as far as being able to sell these luxury branded condos. Mostly they're aligning themselves with high fashion or auto brands. We've already seen Armani, Bentley, Fendi, Missoni, Porsche. You know, so all these names are out there. They're designed to attract the high-end buyer who wants to align themselves with these fashion brands. You know, it's separating themselves from the pack, and that's the high-end pack.
So Mr. Beckler, if I could just throw it out there, you've been down in the South for quite some time. You came from New York in the 80s. You've been down here on the ground for 40 years, roughly. The location of this property is west of the Mr. Rail tracks. It's probably a four-block walk from Brickell Avenue, even though they're referring to it as the Brickell neighborhood. It's actually located next to a fire department. It's across the street from a rental tower. Catty corner would be a Chase Bank branch where you could drive your car through. It's a one-story facility. Next to that is a gas station. You have a nice Walgreens, which is one story, and you have a Publix. $550,000 for a unit. Okay, call it a reasonable price. They don't say the square footage. But what I'm wondering is, does that reflect the Mercedes-Benz brand being across from a bank branch with a drive-through ATM, a gas station, a Walgreens that's open 24/7 so you can get booze or you can get cigarettes or you can get anything else, as well as a Publix? Is that Mercedes-Benz brand?
No, it's not, obviously. But the design concept, which was talked about in the story.
This is the south, the cool pole and the hot pole?
Exactly. Oh, it's sort of based on the Bauhaus, a German theory of architecture. So they're using that as a springboard, the actual design of the place, to attract the customers. Not so much the location. So, you know, again, they're trying to compete with each high-end luxury legacy brand. They're trying to outdo each other. And I think that's kind of more to do with this than location, obviously. It's not the greatest location as far as I'm concerned. I mean, certainly I wouldn't associate it with Mercedes-Benz, but, you know, I'm more middle class, so I wouldn't really be able to judge that. But that's just my theory.
John, Oscar, am I wrong? Am I being too critical of this design? I mean, granted, you can knock down that gas station. You can remediate the dirt. You can put up another tower there. Whoa. You can knock down the Walgreens and put up a tower. You can knock down the Publix. The fire station you can't get rid of. There's a sushi place across the street. I think it's like $12 a dish. Am I being too critical for what Mercedes-Benz represents, or is there a little bit of a disconnect between what Mercedes-Benz is supposed to be and what this location is?
Well, personally, I think I should have been the Kia Tower.
So,
Anybody who doesn't know, Kia is a brand out of South Korea that is value-oriented for value-oriented
buyers. First of all, it's
buyers.
A fantastic car, by the way. It's one of the best cars out there.
Still.
I know. That's why they should have a Kia Tower. It'd be a huge hit. I mean, it's just all marketing sizzle. I mean,
exactly.
You know, one of the big questions that I have is what happens in 20 years when the building is, you know, sort of gets dilapidated and run down? Is Mercedes-Benz going to stick around? You're not going to see that Mercedes-Benz marketing anywhere near that building. I mean, that is a finite thing to sell the units. I mean, what I would be really interested to see is in the condo documents, how long is the marketing agreement with Mercedes-Benz? How long is Mercedes-Benz going to allow its name to be used to sell these units? And I'm also curious, like, okay, well, what does Mercedes get out of it? I think that would be very interesting. I'd be very interested to know that. And, you know, ultimately, the building, once it's sold, I mean, can Mercedes walk away and decide that it shouldn't have its name on the top and they're just using the sizzle of Mercedes or Pagani or whatever Bentley, Porsche, whatever. I mean, it's gotten ridiculous. I mean, every luxury car has a building now. I mean, it's just ridiculous.
Okay.
And we've been talking about this on the podcast for the last few years.
Can I have my say?
Yeah, but let me just ask her. Well, let me ask Mr. Fackler one question. Mr. Fackler, because it was your story and, you know, you have a German designer. You're of German descent. You proudly wear your Deutschland shirt.
There you go.
I don't know if you speak German or not, but isn't Volkswagen, isn't that supposed to be the people's car based on the location? Wouldn't Volkswagen have been more apropos rather than Mercedes-Benz, which is, you know, like some sort of distinguished luxury? Could you kind of give us your take on that before we go to Oscar?
You're actually right. I mean, it's more the people's car, the Volkswagens. But obviously, they're going for the sizzle. They're going for the high-end brand. And again, they're just trying to outdo each other, these different luxury legacy brands. So I think that's got more to do with anything.
Okay, Oscar, Mustafa, the floor is yours.
All right. So Miami Beach, Miami, are the cities of imagination. I mean, you had Morris Lapidus, who created the Fountain Blue and used his marketing skills to create such a unique product that it was, you know, the emblem of Miami Beach for many years. And to the point where now the Sofers have expanded it and created condos there. And what that tells you is that you can create a brand identity in any neighborhood if you incorporate interesting design, interesting brands, interesting ideas. Sunny Isles is another example. The Desert family created tower after tower, including Porsche Tower, right? That across the street from those incredible places, you know, these very high-end towers, is a Kentucky Fried Chicken, or at least it was until a few years ago. You know, the last
Don't
time
forget
I was
the Burger King.
Huh?
They have a Burger King and a Navarro discount.
Right.
Obviously.
And there was a Wolfie's across the street also that's gone now. And I loved Wolfie's, but that's not what's across the street on the ocean, you know? So it tells you the story of how people who come here want to live out their dreams. They want to have this fairy tale, this fantasy play out, even if it's just for a week, if they're vacationing here or if they're investing in a condominium that is put into, you know, like a hotel dynamic, like a condo hotel or whatever. I mean, the reality is that these people are creating opportunities that will last 10 years, 15 years, 20 years, a generation. That's a long time, you know. Morris Lapidus.
It's true, Oscar.
Yeah.
Well, Oscar, so just to clarify, you're talking about Sunny Isles and how there's a KFC across the street from a Trump Tower that's on the sand. So this particular Mercedes-Benz site's about 6 blocks from the bay. Are you saying because of global sea level rise, the water is going to extend to this Mercedes and then suddenly it'll get the kicker because it would be waterfront?
So what I'm saying is, that's
that
funny.
That is tongue-in-cheek.
Yes,
that
yes,
is tongue
that's
in cheek.
Funny. Yeah, yeah. You're going to get a letter from Mercedes-Benz probably. But the bottom line is that I think that what Miami real estate is about is dreams, making dreams out of places that you never imagined would be, you know, viable as luxury. You know, like the one hotel when it came to Miami Beach, I didn't know anything about that brand. But now everybody, I think, everybody knows it. How do I know? Because I
have Mr. Fackler, do you know the one hotel?
Spoken like a true PR guy there, Oscar. I'm sorry.
What about
the
Faena?
One hotel, Mr.
What about
Fackler? What was the question?
You know, do you know the Faena?
Mr. Fackler, do you know of a place called the One Hotel in Miami Beach?
No, I don't.
Okay. Go ahead, Mr. Musabai.
All right. So
and so the audience knows we're having fun.
Yes.
We all know each other.
Yes.
We all respect each other.
Yes.
This is just the banter.
Yes,
back
but
and
One
forth.
Hotel is a luxury hotel and condominium, right? And I can tell you that it's a very busy location that people who have, you know, discretionary income are spending their money there, just like they're spending it at the Fontainebleau, just at the new Fontainebleau, just like they're spending it at these very high-end condominium destinations.
And if anybody doesn't know, One Hotel is located roughly about 24th or so in Collins.
That's right.
It has a common wall with the Roney Palace, which you might recognize, and Lafrique Group was the one that was involved with going ahead and converting it way back in the way.
And Faena,
way back in the day. So
Faena is another brand that before it came here, I wasn't familiar with, right? And
yeah, but Oscar, I don't know if Faena is a good example. Why? Because we were supposed to have a whole district, and Mr. Faena, he was known for wearing a white outfit and a white hat. He sold his mansion. He unloaded the dirt he had left. He hightailed it back to Argentina. And now there's a project going up, which would have been a latest phase of Faena. It's now called the Aman.
Okay.
So I'm not sure if Faena is a good example.
Well, what I'm suggesting to you is that there is the ability to create destinations through these brands and by spending a lot of money on places that maybe have lost their luster, and someone new comes in and says, I can redo all this. And I think that is where the opportunity lies and the future of Miami lies. And if we are the financial capital, they're not living in Hialeah. They're living on the beach. They're living in Brickell. Brickell is a very strong office market, as it turns out. Now, going back to that story, every market, every cycle has an end. And are we at that end? I don't know. We will find out as more product comes onto the market. But in terms of us becoming the financial capital, us having all these brands here, it's a sign that there is another level of investment on a regular basis, discretionary income on a level that we haven't had before, that is fueling this type of expansion. And people see that who have money, developers, et cetera, and they're like, well, if he can do it, I can do it, you know? And they jump on that and they try to replicate that. Now, which one is the last one when the music stops, right? Which chair is the last chair left? We don't know yet because we haven't gotten there yet. It's still continuing. There are lots of people want to come here. More people. This is why spring break is being dealt with the way it is because there's a lot of people here in Miami Beach. And it's a lot for the infrastructure that we have. So, Miami is going to continue to be a location that people look to because of our taxes, because of our weather, because of our, you know, because of all the amenities that have been created in the last decade. It's going to continue to be a destination that's going to draw more and more investment. So that's
point taken, Oscar. That was a great pushback. I appreciate that. I want to thank all of the panelists for participating in episode one of season five of the podcast. We're going to be doing these every week. We'll be doing a live broadcast on Tuesdays, and then the podcast will be edited and posted on Friday. So let me thank John Gruss. John was a journalist for over 25 years. Right now, he has a public relations and marketing firm called Gruss Communications. You want to check out his website, go to grusspr.com, grusspr.com. You want to get him on X or Twitter, get him at Jean Gruss, JEANGRUSS. Let me thank John Fackler. John was a journalist for over 20 years. Mr. Fackler he worked at the South Florida Business Journal. Right now, he does public relations and marketing consulting. You want to reach him on Twitter, you can get him at JT Fackler, JTFAKLER. And I want to thank Oscar Musabai, a journalist for over 20 years, worked at a variety of different publications, including the Daily Business Review. Right now, Oscar is still doing some public relations, but he's moved into the real estate game. He is pushing, what is it, Oscar, office space, retail space.
I focus on commercial opportunities. So look me up on Twitter, and I'm sure I can help you find what you need.
Look him up on Twitter. His handle is, well, Twitter is now known as X. His handle is Omusibay, O-M-U-S-I-B-A-Y. And I'm Peter Zalewski from Condo Vultures. If you have any comments for us, do you have any questions for us, go ahead and hit us up on Twitter, which is formerly Twitter. Now it's called X. Get us at Miami RRP, at Miami RRP, which stands for Miami Reporters Roundtable Podcast, not AARP, even though we were some of our guests were complaining about twerking and dancing and everything else. We're not in that phase, but get us at Miami RRP. And don't forget, every Friday, we'll put up the edited version of the podcast. Tuesdays are live. Check out my website, condovultures.com. Until next time, take care of yourself.
Wait, Peter, we'll catch up soon. I have a question. So,
yes, Oscar.
Can you describe the future shows, how they're going to look and how they're going to work?
Yeah, we'll describe that in the next podcast. So,
all right.
Thanks, everybody, for tuning in. Much appreciated.
All right. See you.
Take care. Ciao.
It's a simple formula, and it works. Buy low, sell high. We're Condo Vultures, and when it comes to your real estate, we help you buy low. At Condo Vultures, we represent the buyer, and now's the time to buy. Log on to condovultures.com for more information. Condovultures.com. And remember, before you sell high, you have to buy low. Featured in the New York Times, Wall Street Journal, 60 Minutes, and Time Magazine. Condo Vultures Realty, a licensed Florida real estate brokerage capitalizing on the condo correction since 2006.
This is Peter Zalewski of the Condo Vultures podcast. Before I started doing these podcasts, I've been in the business of being a licensed real estate broker, a contributing columnist for the Miami Herald, as well as the Miami Real Deal, but also extra witness work in consulting. So if you are looking for an expert witness, or if you're looking for consulting services, a straight talk perspective as to what's going on in a particular marketplace, a building, or what happened previously, for whatever your situation is, whether you are an attorney, whether you are a institutional fund looking to invest, or whether you're a lender who's trying to come up with some sort of a strategy and approach for your lending committee going forward, I don't just might be able to help you. To get a hold of me, please reach out to peter@condovultures.com. That's peter@condovultures.com. Or give me a call to the office at 305-865-5859, 305-865-5859.